You're listening to a recording from the 2017 Gospel Coalition National Conference.
Thanks, Russell, and thanks to all of you for the invite. I gotta say, I have to talk a lot in life, and I get a broad range of introductions. It's pretty rare that there's a Methodist joke in the introduction, so I gotta feel like I'm among my people. Russell said a number of things that were important. He and I hadn't actually spoken about what I was going to talk about today, but I think I might briefly flag the point that he made about what I call a humble politics. I'm not going to talk about any partisan political policy issues today. I'm going to talk a little bit about politics as in the root of the word, meaning about power, because there's a whole bunch of things about this world that are obviously broken, and power is necessary as a framework for an age where broken people might want to take each other's life and liberty and stuff. So I'm going to talk about politics because it relates to the order of things, but I'm not talking about partisan policy issues at all. I didn't have a plan to talk much about Russell's point about humble politics, but I will say, just as a brief biographical point, I'm one of five people in the U.S. Senate who's never been a politician before. I'm also the only person in the Senate who's doing a family commute. Usually, if you're the only person doing something, that's a pretty good sign that you're young and foolish. But we have kids who are 15, 13, and 5, and this wasn't and isn't my dream calling. My dream calling is to be offensive coordinator for the Nebraska Cornhuskers. And I frankly, when I was running for office, I heard some Husker shout out over here, so thank you, go Big Red. When I was running, I told the people of Nebraska that I'm a crisis turnaround guy. I go in and help institutions that are in the midst of really, you know, sort of existential crises. They might go bankrupt. And so I usually stay 3 or 6 or 9 months or however long it takes to turn something around. And I don't have any commitment phobias about my wife and my marriage and my family, but I have kind of commitment phobias about a job. And so when I was running for office and the Senate has 6-year terms, I told Nebraskans in both my primary election night speech and my general election night speech, thank you for this new calling, but know that I'm putting an asterisk on it. If the athletic department in Lincoln calls, I'm out of here. So I wasn't planning to be a politician. And I ended up in public life partly because of religious liberty and First Amendment concerns, and I'll touch on that briefly today. But more fundamentally, I ended up in politics, and it isn't normal. Again, 95 out of 100 people in the Senate have run for a bunch of things en route to wanting to be in the Senate. I ran for public office partly because I think we are having a crisis of people deciding to project grand meaning onto politics. And politics can't bear that weight. And we have a glorious inheritance in America of having been privileged to inherit something where our entire structure of government was sort of based on the idea that statism could be dangerous and politics has necessary purposes, but not ultimate purposes. That's a pretty special gift that we've failed to pass on to the next generation. There's a ton of data which shows our young people don't really understand the American experiment and the American idea. And so I'm in public life because I want to recover a sense that politics can only work well if it's a framework, but not the center. Politics can only work well in America if you're not trying to find your greatest hopes and find the greatest enemies that you want to demonize in politics. It's not made for that. And so when I ran for public life, I actually believed that the vast majority of Nebraskans and Americans have my view, not the cable TV news view, and not the Washington, D.C. centric view. I still have that view, but with a lot less certainty than I used to have. And that's what I'd like to talk about now a little bit today, which is I want to bring together three moments. I want to pick up on the fact that this is the 500th anniversary of Luther at the church door in Wittenberg, and I want to talk a little bit about the catechetical impulse that flowed from the Reformation. I'm not going to talk narrowly or centrally about soteriology this morning, but I want to talk a little bit about catechesis and about Christian identity and about Christian memory and about Christian hope, something the Reformers did a great service to us in trying to restore. I want to talk, as the title of my hour with you says, about the relationship between Washington and Jerusalem. But I want to parse Washington and what it means in historical view two different ways. What did Washington mean historically, again, what was America about at its founding? And I'm not here to give you any sort of sanctified view of American history as the most important moment in global history, but I want to say that we've inherited something special, and what Washington used to mean had a special fit with a lot of what we believe about the grand hopes that we have across time and history and for Christ's return. But secondly, I want to talk about what Washington is coming to mean in a time when there's a vacuum of meaning in people's lives because of the era of economic disruption that we're living through. So I want to connect three moments. History of sort of what America meant, the disrupted moment we're living in, and what do the reformers potentially have to say to us, and what is the Gospel Coalition doing to think seriously about catechesis again? Because many of you are involved at the local level in doing some incredibly important work, and I'd like to set that in the sweep of the reformers' catechetical impulse up to now and what you all have been doing over the last decade. I just this morning learned that John Piper spoke a little bit last night about the New City Catechism, so I'm not going to talk narrowly about that, or I'm not going to talk precisely about that document, though that had been a little bit of my plan. But instead, I want to connect these three historical moments. I'm going to do it out of order. First, I want to start by talking about the disrupted moment in which we live, because we live at a unique time in human history. I'm a historian by background. I'm a business turnaround guy by work history, but I'm an academic historian by training. And usually, historians' job at dinner parties is to sort of be the skunk who says, let me tell you why continuity is almost always the right answer when you talking here at this dinner party believe that we live at this discontinuous moment, right? You think that we're at a time of really great disruption. Let me be the guy that everybody's bored by at the dinner party, and let me tell you why you're wrong. Actually, there's almost always more continuity than discontinuity. All humans just tend to think that our moment is uniquely disrupted, and that's because we're narcissists. And we're here, and so we think this moment is unique because I'm here, so it must be the most interesting time, and usually you're wrong. Today, I want to suggest that we actually do live at an extraordinarily disruptive moment. What we're going through right now, and by today, I don't mean these 2 months or these 2 years, I mean the last 10, 20, 30 years and the coming 50 to 100 years. We live at a fairly unique time in human history, and I want to anchor that around economics, but I want to layer on top of that what it means in terms of the disruption of core markers people have of their identities. And again, this relates to my experiential last 2.5 years as a newbie in public life, 16 months living on a campaign bus with little kids, and then 2.5 years in Washington, D.C., where I'm traveling and doing hundreds and hundreds and maybe thousands of events and town halls over the course of this 4-year sweep, and finding people all across my state and all across the country who know that something is deeply disrupted. Something is deeply unsettling about the moment that we live in, and that has huge familial and sociological and mediating institution implications. But fundamentally, at its root, we live at a time that we don't have very good categories to talk about in the changing nature of work. And what I mean by that is that at the macro level, there have only been 4 kinds of economies in human history. There were hunter-gatherers, there were settled agrarian farmers and the villages that they created. There was the rise of industrialization and the rise of the big tool economy and the rise of cities. Think 1870 to 1920, where you have these mass migrations across oceans and across the US where farm kids moved to cities. In 1865, 86% of Americans lived and worked on the farm. Okay, 86% of people at the end of the Civil War work on the farm. By the front end of World War II, only 70 years later, more than 60% of Americans live and work in cities. This was an unbelievably disruptive thing, industrialization, mass immigration, urbanization. And then there's this fourth economy, this thing we've entered now. Sometimes we call it the knowledge economy, the IT economy, the service economy. We don't really know what to call it, and so sociologists have finally just thrown in the towel, and they've started to refer to it as the post-industrial economy, which is another way of saying we don't know the name. So hunter-gatherers, they were nomads. Settled farmers built villages, lots of social capital. America arises out of a unique moment in agrarian Tocquevillianism. Then the rise of industrialization and cities only 150 years ago. And now, some disruption that we don't know how to make sense of, but in a weird way, even your organization is an echo of it. The Gospel Coalition, I asked some of the guys backstage, so where do you live? Where's headquarters? And they said, oh, we don't have any headquarters. Well, where do your people live? Oh, we have about 30 of us, and we live all across the country, and we just telecommute, and we Skype, and we FaceTime. That is really, really interesting. The opportunities that flow from that are kind of spectacular. But the ways that that unsettles humans, we haven't made much sense of yet, and we don't have many categories to talk about that in common. Some of you know Arthur Brooks, the head of the American Enterprise Institute. Fascinating guy. If you don't know him, I highly recommend him. He has a book, The Conservative Heart, that is well worth reading. And again, like me, Arthur's not primarily talking about policy prescriptions, as important as those are. But Arthur's fascinated by happiness. Arthur's a strange bird. He was a French horn player who dropped out of college and ended up in symphonies across Europe and ended up marrying a woman who spoke a language that he didn't really speak. And over time, Arthur realized that he didn't want to be a professional musician, and he became a trained economist. And over time, he said, economics is interesting, but I'm really interested in all these matters of the human soul. And so he made up a discipline that didn't really exist, and he became what he conceives of as a social scientist of happiness. I think of him as an Aristotelian philosopher looking for data to justify his and my shared beliefs, but whatever. Arthur has looked at about 2,500 social science articles over the last decade plus about what makes people happy, and it's really fascinating. And I say this as stage setting for the context and the culture in which we live and in which you all are ministering. Arthur found in these 2,000 plus articles that it turns out happiness is a lot simpler equation than you might imagine. We tend to think that there are hundreds or thousands of variables that drive whether or not people are happy or not. And Arthur said, actually, there's a whole bunch of stuff that seems to be driven by your genetics, and there's some stuff that's driven based on whether or not you live in moments of existential crisis. Do you live in a place where there's not enough food or there's lots of war? Is there famine or is there bloodshed? If there is, your life is going to be messy. But if you set aside the genetics and you set aside these sort of macro disruptive events, Arthur's research suggests that there are only four things that drive human happiness. It's kind of amazing. If you'd have surveyed people how many things affect whether or not you're happy, most of us would have assumed that number is hundreds or at least dozens or scores. He found that there are only four, and they are these. Do you have a theological framework to make sense of death and suffering? Do you have a worldview that can explain where you are in time and space? Number two, do you have a family? Are there people in your home that love you, that you feel their pleasure when they're happy, and you feel their pain when they're hurting, and vice versa? Not as a choice, but because you're family. You actually are anchored. Number three, do you have community? And really, this is an Aristotelian definition of community. He really just means, do you have two or three friends? Which is people that, like your family members, have an expansive sense of the self, such that when you're happy, they're happy. And when you hurt, they're sad. They don't choose it. It just happens. It's who they are because they love you. Do you have friends? And number four, and in his data, in the social science research, the biggest marker, the biggest identifier, the biggest anchor of whether or not people are happy is, do they have work? Do they have a calling? This is a broad sense of work. This is vocation. It's a Reformation category that Luther would understand well. Do you have work? When you leave home on Monday morning, are you going somewhere where you believe that people will benefit from the work that you do? Does it matter? Not do you make a lot of money, not does it hurt, not is it stressful, not are my knees or back sore at the end of the day, but fundamentally, do I think it matters? Am I needed somewhere? Theological framework, family, community or friends, narrowly defined, a couple of friends. Not do 500 or 200 or 2,000 people know you on Facebook, but are there a few actual people who know you and feel your pain? And what's the nature of your work? Well, here's the moment we live at as we transition from this industrial era to whatever the post-industrial era is, where we're all really, really mobile and rootless in ways that are opportunity producing, surely, but also in ways that are really scary to people. Three of those four anchors of identity are hugely disrupted at the present moment. The family is going through a crisis that we don't even really know how to make sense of. When I sit in Daniel Patrick Moynihan's desk on the floor of the U.S. Senate, I'm the third or fourth most conservative guy in the Senate by voting record. Again, that's irrelevant to our discussion here, but I'm a conservative. Daniel Patrick Moynihan was one of the more liberal guys in the U.S. Senate, but I love the work that Moynihan did, and I chose to sit in his desk on purpose for a couple of reasons, one of which is that he's the author of the famous quote, "Everyone is entitled to your own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts." There is an order to the world, and it's objective, and it's knowable, and people can have shared facts. The second is because Moynihan, in the mid-1960s, Moynihan, in the mid-1960s, was the first to identify the demographic tidal wave that we sat upon, as he identified the crisis of the urban family at the time. He was looking at the black family, and he said that out-of-wedlock birth rates in America as a whole are 7%, but out-of-wedlock birth rates among black families in the mid-1960s were 24%. And he said this will never work. People cannot raise kids. Kids cannot be well raised. America cannot reproduce virtuous citizens capable of independent living if they don't come out of an orderly home life where their identities are anchored in love. And he said, this won't work at 24% out of wedlock birth rates. Today, 40% of kids in America, without regard to race, this is everybody's problem. This isn't a racial category from the 1960s. 40% of kids in America are being raised without any meaningful connection to dad. And the demographic cliff we sit on is much, much bigger than that, because when you disaggregate by the age of mom, what you actually find is there's still a whole bunch of 38 and 40-year-old women having their fourth kid in stable families, and you have a world where a whole bunch of people born to women under age 30, actually 59% of kids being born to women under age 30 now, have no meaningful connection to dad. That doesn't work, but that was one of the fundamental drivers of happiness. Like that, friendship is eroding rapidly. We live in a country of people that are stunningly lonely, and we don't have categories to make sense of this. As recently as 1990, the average American had almost 3.5 friends, again, defined in that Aristotelian sense of people who really identify with you and feel your pain and feel your pleasure. Today, it's about 1.8. There's a halving of Americans' friends in just 25 years. All across the country, people are crying out in loneliness and trying to find other substitutes to give them meaning. And the nature of work, that economic history that I flagged through real quickly, we live at a time when the average duration of a job is getting shorter and shorter and shorter. That's a big deal, obviously. But if we reflected on the fact that this has never happened before in human history, this is truly unique. Hunter-gatherers and settled farmers basically never chose jobs. They just inherited jobs. They did what their parents and grandparents had always done. It wasn't a reflective choice. Maybe 1% or 2% went off and were ministers or were lawyers or were some sort of early doctors. But by and large, people just inherited their callings. They didn't choose it. And then there was this big disrupted moment when people left the farm and moved to the cities. And a lot of social theorists thought America can't possibly work in this era. If people leave the anchored social capital and density and relational networks of Tocquevillian America, a Lockean theory of the commons, how will there ever be a republic of virtue? How will there ever be accountability where your neighbors or somebody that you identify with if you're mobile? And as the father of teenage girls, I get why it was scary from 1870 to 1900 when there were teenage males migrant across the landscape. That sounds scary to me. But once people left the farm and got to the city, it turned out that the big panic, the Jeremiads of the time, were wrong. It turned out that social capital could be reproduced in urban ethnic neighborhoods. And so a lot of what Americans worried about at the turn of the 20th century with the rise of progressivism, they were overstated in their panic. And it wasn't really necessary. And so there was a Tocquevillian sense of America that was reproduced in cities. But what they worried about then is what is actually happening now. What is actually happening is people's relational networks and fundamentally the work that anchors them to a place is being disrupted. We're not nomads, but those were groups and communities and tribes that traveled together with extended kin. We're not living in a village anymore. We're not living in the same urban ethnic neighborhood anymore. We're by and large migrants across exurbia, and the average duration at a job, which was still 3 decades when I was born in the mid-1970s, is now less than 4 years. The average duration at a job is getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. We're gonna have to create lifelong learners as people who are 45 and 50 and 55 lose their jobs, something that's never happened before in human history. Right now, when you lose your job, if you're 50 or 55, by and large, you never get employed again. The opioids crisis, something that was on nobody's radar 20 years ago, is now the number one issue in a lot of polling in New Hampshire about what people are worried about the future of America. That is an echo of people not knowing where they're from. And here's what that means in Washington. What that means in Washington is that if you're worried about the political idolatry that can rise in political contexts, if you're worried, if you're an advocate for humble politics, if you think that politics has a purpose to create a framework for ordered liberty, but that's so that you can go find meaning in your neighborhood and in your community and fundamentally in your church and in your eschatology and in your hope and in your Messiah, it turns out there are a bunch of people that don't like humble politics because they want to find a way to project tribalism and good versus evil on divides between right versus left. None of these people in either of these political parties are really interesting enough to cast your grand hopes on. What America meant when it was founded, what American exceptionalism used to mean, was an understanding, not a claim that Americans were better than other people. American exceptionalism was never a claim about ethnicity. American exceptionalism was never a claim about Americans' unique anthropology. American exceptionalism was an understanding about the historical moment in which the American founding flipped on its head the relationship between rights and government. Because we live in a broken world and because government is necessary, because order is essential in this broken place, most people throughout human history have said, it's good that we have a king. We're grateful for that benefit. And therefore, we better inherit whatever divine right we get. Might makes right, and we're glad that there's some order keeper. And so we'll wait for him or her to give us rights. And so if you had a picture, one of the ways that I love to teach sort of basic civics to American high school kids is to draw an island and surround it by an ocean on this side of the whiteboard, and draw another island and surround it by an ocean on that side of the whiteboard, and label government and rights on one side and flip the picture on the other. Throughout most of human history, rights were the island that the government or the king decreed that you could have, and the ocean was the limitless powers of the government. Here's all that America meant. Here's all that Washington meant at the founding. We changed the picture. Our founders actually said government is the island. We give it enumerated powers. And the ocean are the limitless rights of the people. And it was because of an anthropological claim about human dignity. The American founding is a claim that God gives us rights, not government, and government is our secular shared project to secure those rights. That's all American exceptionalism means. That's what Washington used to mean. Increasingly, we live in an age where people want to project great meaning on politics. This won't work. We live in a time when people want the dividing line, Manichaean line between good and evil, to run between political parties. It's not gonna fulfill them. It's not gonna satisfy them. We live in an age that yearns for a city that has foundations. Well, that's normal. That's natural. That's something that the reformers could relate to. But the guardrails we need to have in our heart, the cultural awareness we need to have about our neighbors, the catechesis we need to do for our kids and for our parishioners and to our spouses in the first church that the reformers called it, the family, the place where we're fundamentally anchoring our and their worldviews, the guardrails we need to build are those that say, we're a forgetful people. We have always yearned to have a city that had foundations. We've always wanted to make it happen in the here and now. As we're entering the week of Palm Sunday, I constantly think every Palm Sunday how much humor there is in Jesus' rebuking of his disciples and in the disciples' goofy claims about how soon the kingdom's gonna come and the power positions they're gonna wield. We miss the humor, right? Jesus is looking to the cross. He's getting ready to go to Jerusalem, and the disciples keep saying, this is really cool. We're on the ground floor of the campaign, and when we get to Jerusalem, and when we call down fire and set up the kingdom, I'm gonna be the deputy assistant secretary of state. hey, Jesus, at the big state dinner, I'm just wondering, I know it's kind of early, but for the banquet, could I sit on your left? Because my brother would like to be on your right. And Jesus is thinking, you guys really don't get it, do you? I'm looking at a cross. Well, there's going to be a seat at my right and my left. And I don't think that's the seat you really want. And this whole text, again and again and again, as we look to the Israelites, this whole text is stories of our forgetfulness and of our hope that the kingdom would come soon and that it would be a worldly kingdom. At our house, we've been reflecting a lot lately on the sort of Genesis 50, Exodus 1, 2. It's an amazing passage, right? Jacob dies, and Joseph's brothers say, oh no, because we sold our brother into slavery, and that didn't quite work out the way we thought it was going to. We live in a poor little country where there's famine and where we don't have a lot of political power. And turns out he's now prime minister of Egypt. And what are we going to do? You know what we need to do? We need to fake dad's will. We need to write up a will and send it down to Egypt and make sure that Joseph knows that Jacob doesn't want us to be punished for what we've done. And what happens? Joseph says, I know, you intended it for ill, but God intended it for good, and you're my family, and it's okay, and come, and I'll give you comfort. It's a pretty glorious picture, right? There's a lot of gospel foreshadowing going on there. And yet what happens? The brothers move to Egypt, and everything's gonna be great, right? And then you turn the page, and you hit Exodus 1. And then there was a Pharaoh who knew not Egypt. And their hopes for worldly power and security, they were dashed, and the slaves are multiplying. And so the Israelites living among the Egyptians are now a new threat. And so then what does the Pharaoh do? He takes his place in the line of Gosnell, and he demands genocide. He says, kill the Israelites. And yet, even in the midst of that stunning, horrific story where there'd been hope and there'd been projection and there'd been grace from God, that they found common grace. They also found forgiveness with their brother. But their hopes to find comfort and security in this world didn't work, and there was going to be a genocide. And yet, even there, Moses writes with this great humor, and I think we miss it, because what happens? The midwives are sent out, and they're supposed to dash all the babies. And what do? They don't want to do this. These are their people. They don't want to kill these little babies. And so what do? They report back to headquarters, and they say, hey, Pharaoh, something we didn't know. Jews, these women, they give birth really, really fast. Turns out they have Pitocin. Nobody knew. But the Jewish women, when they go into labor, boom, the baby's there. So we couldn't kill them all. And so Pharaoh has to come up with yet another plan as a way to eradicate these people who have a hope of a future kingdom. And we don't have the time to do it because Colin and I are going to sit and do a little bit of an interview instead. But what I wanted to do, and if we had more time, and when you have actual preachers standing in front of you over the course of today and tomorrow, I wanted to scan from Genesis 50 and Exodus 1 to Ecclesiastes 8 to Isaiah 40. To Isaiah 65, to Hebrews 2, to Ephesians 6. And what happens as you go through text after text after text? The reformers find their anchor that says, we're a forgetful people. And as a forgetful people, we always think we're about to establish the kingdom on earth. We always think that by our own hands, we're going to bring about the kingdom of God. And it is our calling, and it is your calling, to preach to ourselves, to preach to our congregations, to preach to our kids, to preach to our neighbors, to recognize all of this ambassadorial language throughout our text, again and again as messengers and as proclaimers and as ambassadors, we have the task of setting up an embassy that says, your yearning for a city that has foundations is natural. But the king that you yearn for is supernatural. And he is coming again, and he is a liberator. And he has actually already arrived on a distant shore This is not a platonic dualism of the material versus the spiritual world. This is, the reformers told us, about the future kingdom breaking into the present evil age. The dualism that we know is the dualism between this evil age, where we think by our own power we can establish security and comfort and happiness and hope and durable jobs and stable families and true community and loving neighbors that are always reconciled and reconciling. And what really is our hope is the Messiah who comes and who breaks in and on Sunday morning, as you preach, announces all the truths of the kingdom that is to come, of the new Jerusalem, of the city that has foundations, about the fact that we, as we lived as dual citizens in this age, as we rightly, like Luther said, to build good shoes for our neighbor, and as we rightly try to do citizenship well and to build a republic that we can pass on to the next generation, it is a loving service, but it is a temporal, limited service. The kingdoms of this age are filled with idolatry, and we have been collaborators in that idolatry. And we will again fail and stumble and fall, but the kingdom that is to come, the king, the ruler of the city that has foundations, has already won. And he will be breaking into that present evil age again this Sunday morning with a proclamation of freedom and a proclamation of hope. And let me close with just a brief passage from Revelation 21, one of the many examples, again and again, of where we're told to look to that city that is with foundations, that it city that is to come. Revelation 21. Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. Remember, the sea was the place where all the dark, demonic, scary things were thought to reside. And there was no more sea. And then I, John, saw a new holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them, and he will be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away." And then he who sat on the throne said, "Behold, I will make all things new." And he said to me, "Write, for the words are true and faithful." And I said to him, "It is done." And he said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things. I will be his God, and he will be my son. But the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." And then skipping ahead to verse 22. "But I saw no temple in the New Jerusalem, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The city has no need of the sun or the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light, and the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light. The kings of the earth will bring their glory and honor into it. Its gates shall be shut. Its gates shall not be shut at all by day, for there is no night there. And they shall bring the glory and honor of the nations into it. And there shall by no means enter into it anything that defiles or causes an abomination or a lie, but only those who are written in the Lamb's book of life. And he showed me a pure river of water, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb, and in the middle of its street, and on either side of the river was the tree of life, which bore 12 fruits." And skipping ahead, "And then he said to me, 'These words are faithful and true.' And the Lord God of the holy prophets sent his angel to show his servants the things which must shortly take place. 'Behold, I am coming quickly,' he said." I have a friend who is a minister whose father recently died. And my friend was traveling across the country to preach at the funeral. And it was a mixed assembly. And he was aching and he was hurting, thinking about how he would preach at his own dad's funeral. How would he honor his father? How would he preach the gospel? How would he not give false comfort? How would he not break down and weep as he delivered the word of hope? And I said to him as he was getting on the plane and going to write his sermon, I said, well, what are you going to call it? And he said, why we weep and why we hope. And it hit me that there are a whole bunch of people that we live among, and sadly, there are too many of us that too much of the time look like people who would act like something as mundane as politics might possibly be the answer to a question like, why do you weep and why do you hope? That's an absurd answer. The answer for why we weep and why we hope is because our God is coming quickly, and he is a liberating king, and he is the ruler of the city that has foundations, the hope of the nations. Will you pray with me? Great God in heaven, we thank you for common grace. We thank you for your gifts to us. The fact that we in this assembly today do not really know famine. Few here have ever known war. We can assemble freely. We have a gift of free speech and press and assembly and religion. We are grateful for these gifts, but we know that in this age, none of these things are secure. And so we pray that you would give us more fundamentally, perseverance and hope and congregations and a gospel ministry that is clear about you in whom we put our actual hope. Maranatha, O God, in Jesus' name, amen.